Harris, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really glad to be here this morning, glad to be sober, Memorial Day weekend, and I want to thank Chris and the group for asking me to do this. This workshop's going to be on the promises, and you know, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's many promises in this book. I mean, this book is riddled with promises, and so I'm not just going to address page 83 and 84 because they're all throughout the book and stuff, but I love to talk about this. I have done my homework on this one, let me tell you guys, but anyway, I'm delighted to be here and so on and so forth. I want to start by reading page, if anybody's got their books, please follow me, page 571. I love the back part of this book, the medical opinion, the you know, all this stuff in the back of the book. There's promises riddled in the back of the book. But anyway, on page 571 it says, Dr. Harry Thibault, psychiatrist. As a psychiatrist, I have thought a great deal about the relationship of my specialty to AA, and I've come to the conclusion that our particular function can often lie in preparing the way for the patient to accept any sort of treatment or outside help. I now conceive the psychiatrist's job to be the task of breaking down the patient's inner resistance so that which is inside him will flower as under the activity of the AA program. Now, on the next page, Dr. W.W. Bauer, broadcasting under the auspices of the American Medical Association in 1946, over the NBC network, said in part, Alcoholics Anonymous are no crusaders, not a temperance society. They know that they must never drink. They help others with similar problems. In this atmosphere, the alcoholic often overcomes his excessive concentration upon himself. Learning to depend upon a higher power and absorb himself in his work with other alcoholics, he remains sober day by day. The days add up to weeks, the weeks into months and years. Dr. John F. Stoford, chief psychiatrist of Philadelphia General Hospital, cited his experience with AA, said, the alcoholics we get here at Philadelphia General are mostly those who cannot afford private treatment, and AA is by far the greatest thing we have been able to offer them. Even among those who occasionally land back in here again, we observe a profound change in personality. You would hardly recognize them. And to me, what that's talking about is that if I do this stuff, I'm going to change. And if I don't do it, nothing's going to happen. That's what that means to me. But I love that. I just want to read that part of the book. So anyway, like I said, if we don't do this stuff, nothing's going to happen. So I'm going to start on page 124. I also want to tell you guys that there was a time in my life. My life is pretty much an open book today at 23 years of sobriety. But I mean, there's some things I'm not going to ever repeat from a podium. It's from my sponsor's ears. But pretty much I tell the whole deal from this podium. And I was never going to tell anybody any of this stuff, ever. Was anybody going to drag this information? So let me tell you, if you're new here today, you know, please don't be in shock by some of the stuff I'm going to tell you, because it's just part of my story. I'm not telling your story. I'm telling my story. But, you know, if you're new here and you're afraid to tell people and share with people the things that happened to you, that you will overcome that if you stay here. I want you, and that is a promise in Alcoholics Anonymous. You will overcome that fear of talking to another human being if you hang around and do the stuff. And I know when I was brand new, believe me, I wasn't going to tell anybody nothing. But I love page 124 where it says, cling to the thought that in God's hands the dark past is the greatest possession that you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. I talked about that last night, too. I love to quote that part of the book. That has been so important in my sobriety, I cannot begin to tell you guys. And, you know, I sponsor a lot of women, and I share with these women what happened to me, and they share with me. And I just see, you know, I see them, their eyes, they just light up when somebody else has done the stuff they've done. You know, so it's so important that we do this stuff. But anyway, okay, on page 83 and 84... Hold on here. I don't want to get mixed up, you guys. I can't get mixed up in my little deal here. After, you know, on page 83 and 84, they pretty much address, and I'm going to read that to you, there may be some wrongs we can never fully right. We don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would right them if we could. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. And there may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases. But we don't delay if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. As God's people, we stand on our own feet. We don't crawl before anyone. And then here it starts the promises on page 83 at the bottom. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle those situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. And, you know, I want to talk to you guys about my very first amends I made. So in other words, if we don't make amends, this stuff does not happen. That's what that means to me. But, you know, this book means different things to different people. But quite clearly it says, you know, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, which is step 9, is what they're talking about, in my opinion. But anyway, you know, when I first got my current sponsor, and I went through 19 of them, I'm sorry to say, but when I got Clancy, he told me, he says, I want you to write an inventory. Get it done. I said, I wrote an inventory in treatment. He said, I don't care what you did in treatment. Write an inventory. How do you expect me to help you if you're not willing to share yourself with me? Well, I couldn't come up with an answer for that. So I said, okay. So anyway, you know, he said, you get that inventory done according to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Do exactly what that book says. Read chapter 5. Read it thoroughly. It tells you exactly how to do an inventory. And he said, do I have to point these things out to you, or can you get in that book by yourself? Yeah, I can get in the book by myself. So I threw the book on my dresser, and all I heard was, you can fly to California and read it to me. You know, I heard California. That's all I heard. So that inventory went right out the window. I get ready to go to California. That inventory was not done. I flew out there, and this guy picked me up from the airport. One of Clancy's babies picked me up. And so Harvey took me down to Clancy's office, and he said, Karen, where is your inventory? I said, well, you know, I didn't get it done. And I have never seen him that mad before or since. I thought he was going to drop his dentures, if you want to know the truth. But he was furious at me, and he said, you get in that office and start writing that inventory. He said, if I come in and that pen's not on the paper, you can get your butt on the plane and fly right back to Los Angeles and back to Lincoln, Nebraska, and find yourself a different sponsor. And so, you know, I went in there, and I thought, you know, I know what the inventory wants. It says we're to take a fearless and searching moral inventory and tell God, ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. And I just could not seem to want to do that, let me tell you. But I did get it done, and it took me 2 hours to write that inventory. I wrote down stuff on that paper I would never tell anybody, let me tell you. But, and then that night, I took that world-famous ride up to Oxnard with Clancy and read my inventory by flashlight in his car. And I guess, you know, he feels like, you know, maybe, you know, people do better with that for some reason. So, but anyway, I kept dropping my flashlight. It didn't work for me very well. But anyway, I read that inventory to my sponsor. And I will tell you guys, I told that man stuff I was never going to tell anybody. And then at the very end of my inventory, he said, did you forget anything else? And I blurted out something else I was not going to tell him, you know. So it was dumped right on my sponsor, the whole wad, you know, in one show. But out of that inventory, we sat down the next day and we made an amends list for me. You know, our book says having our amends list, you know. So you do that at the time of your inventory, according to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But so I had my amends list. I had 280 people on that list to make amends to. I was financially in debt. I mean, I was in trouble in every area of my life, let me tell you guys. So Clancy told me, he says, you have no money right now. He said, do that first amend you told me about. Get that woman taken care of. A long time ago, and I had a very dear friend in Lincoln, Nebraska. I worked with this woman for many, many years, and we worked in surgery together, and she was a nurse like I am, and we traveled together. We worked together for 19 years, and she was my very best friend. And we used to travel and go to different places, and we went to Vegas one time, and I stole $40 out of her suitcase. I didn't really steal it. I was just going to borrow it, you know, and then pay it back. But, you know, we lost all our money on the slot machine, so she had won some money, and I thought, well, I'll just borrow it and I'll put it back. But that's stealing. That isn't borrowing. That's stealing. She didn't know I did that. So anyway, obviously, I never got the money back. So, and you know, I never said another word about that, and she never said a word to me about it. And I felt so bad about it. I know it doesn't sound like any big deal to you guys, but it was a big deal to me, let me tell you. I hated myself for that, and I drank over that for years and stuff, but I just could not seem to come up with $40 to give it to her and stuff. So anyway, Clancy told me, he said, that's your first amend. Get it done. And so I was going to get out the big book and the 12x12 and try to pretty the whole damn thing up. And there's nothing pretty about it at all. And my sponsor got so tired of me calling him and asking him about this. He said, Karen, listen to me. He said, call this woman up, make an appointment with her, go over to her house, knock on her door, give her the money, tell her what you did, and tell her what can you do to make it right. That's all you got to do here, okay? And he said, just get it done and don't call me till you do. Well, that took care of that. You know, I got to go do it. And so anyway, I called her up, and she said, well, sure, you can come over. And so I went over to, and met with her. And oh, you guys, I was terrified. You have no idea. I was so scared. I thought I was going to die. But anyway, you know, I had the $40 with me, and it was all the money I had in the whole world, if you want the truth. And anyway, I gave it to her, and I told her what I did. And she says, Karen, I knew that you did that. And I said, why didn't you say something to me? And she said, because I didn't want to lose my very best friend. You know, see, that's what we do to people, folks. That's the kind of crap I did. So, and she says, I don't want your money. And it was like fire in my hands. Now I said, no, it's yours. You know, I wanted to get rid of it and stuff. But, and she said, well, I'll put my little grandson's piggy bank. And then that made me feel worse, you know. But anyway, she took the money. And now this is what I want to talk about. I got a piece of these promises almost immediately. You know, the book says we will be amazed before we were halfway through. I was amazed on my first amends in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I walked out of that woman's house, and we had a nice conversation for a couple hours and stuff, but walked out of that woman's home, and I will tell you, the grass was never greener in Lincoln, Nebraska. The sky was never bluer, and I felt the serenity, the inner peace, the peace of mind that we feel when we make amends in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I will tell you guys, and I mean this very sincerely, I swear to God this is true. I mean, I thought, my God, this thing really works. These people know what they're talking about. And for some reason, I wanted to be by myself. I didn't want to be around people because I knew I'd screw the whole damn thing up. So I drove for a long drive and went out in the country for a couple hours, and I cried and cried and cried and stuff. And I have never felt better in my whole life. And I'm serious about that. I mean that sincerely. Even when I was drinking, using drugs, I never felt that good. And I thought, oh, my God, this is just fabulous and stuff. But, you know, anyway, I went back to Lincoln. I told a couple lies and screwed the whole damn thing up, you know, because the promises come and they go, you know. But I got a piece of it, and I knew this thing worked. Now, don't get me wrong. I still balk at every single one, trust me. But I knew that this thing worked. And, boy, what a great thing that was for me and my sobriety, I'll tell you. But so, anyway, everything is fine between her and I today. Okay, let's see here. Hold on. I just absolutely cannot get lost here. Okay, now, this is the one that was a big deal for me, you guys. My sponsor told me, he says, get up to the State Board of Nursing, Nebraska. Oh, by the way, I wanted to point out, on those amends with that lady, I got that first promise, we're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness, and I got the word, the third promise, we will comprehend the word serenity, we will know peace. You know, and I got those two immediately and stuff. But anyway, you know, Clancy told me, he says, you know, I want you to get that State Board of Nursing and make amends. And I know we heard this last night, but, I only have one story. I'm sorry. But anyway, and so I called, and I was terrified, you guys. I mean, I'd done some bad stuff. I mean, it is not cool to steal narcotics, let me tell you. But anyway, I'd lost that license, and you know my story. But anyway, so I called the State Board of Nursing, and this woman, I just hated this woman that was the director of the State Board of Nursing in Nebraska. And actually, the day I lost my license, she said, you surrender your license. And I said, it's mine, and I paid for it, and you're not getting it, you know. And I said, I won't use it, but you're not getting my license. She said, Karen, I will take you to court and get that license. And I said, whatever, you know. And by God, she did, too. And this woman at one time was a great big fat lady. She was really, really heavy and stuff. And I made some comment about, as a matter of fact, I called her a fat bitch is what I did. But anyway, so that's what I had to deal with. And this woman was still director of nursing, you know, when I got sober. And that's who I was going to have to talk to. And I thought, oh, this is going to be bad news. So Clancy told me, he said, make amends to her for what you said to her, you know. And so I was planning on doing that. But anyway, I got up to the State Board of Nursing. It's at the Capitol in Lincoln, Nebraska. And I got up there on that third floor. And she was the only one that was in the office that day. And my God, she weighed about 120 pounds. I couldn't believe it. And she says, I'm not a fat bitch anymore, am I? She had never forgotten that I said that to her. And I said, I'm so sorry I called you that. Oh, my God, what can I do to make that right? And she said, well, obviously, you never have to do it again, you know. And she says, you know, I needed to hear that, you know. And I thought, this may work well for me, you know. But anyway, I told her, I said, you know, I don't know if you know this or not, but I said, Kathy, I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd like the opportunity to get my nursing license back. And she says, Karen, we have never done this. We have never done this before. And, you know, I had the dubious honor of being the first person in Nebraska that ever got their license back, you guys. But anyway, she said, we don't know what to do. She said, it's not that we don't want to try and help you. She said, you were a great nurse. I know that you were. And you know, but I don't know what they're going to say. And we're going to have to pull the state board. The whole board's going to have to talk about this. And we'll get back with you. But at least she talked to me, you guys. At least I had my foot in the door. So I called Clancy and he said, okay, now don't be calling up there. Let them respond to you. Just keep cool here. Keep a low profile. So a couple days later, she called me and she said, come up and talk to us. We want to talk to you. I thought, oh, my God, I can't believe this. Nobody ever would get their license back at that time, you guys. In 1982, it was unheard of, let me tell you. They didn't have nursing diversion and medical diversion, all that kind of stuff in those days. But thank God now they had that stuff to help people. But not in those days, they didn't. So I thought, boy, I don't know what they're going to do. But, you know, I went up to the state board and I met with these people. And it's 11 women. And these people do not think we're cute, let me tell you guys. You know, they think it's a moral issue and they're not cool with what I did, I can tell you. And they said, Karen, we have never done this before. What do you think you should have to do? And I thought, nothing. Give my license back. You know, I didn't say that, though. You know, that had been a stupid thing to say. And I said, well, actually, you know, I suppose that I should have to stay sober a couple years, and I suppose that I should have to, you know, do a lot of things that you want me to do, and I don't know what to do. And they said, we want to hear what you're willing to do. And I said, I'm willing to do anything you ask me to do. You know, my sponsor told me I know two words with these people, yes and okay. Don't say nothing else. Just shut your mouth, you know. And they said, you write out what you think you should have to do. And I gave a lot of thought to this, and I got a lot of feedback from people in Alcoholics Anonymous in Lincoln, Nebraska, too. But, you know, and so here's what we came up with. We came up with that I should have to see a psychiatrist once a week. That's a stupid idea. But anyway, we did that. That I should have to drop a urine screen once a week. That's a good idea, right? And that I should have to do a lot of things and maybe see some counseling, go back into counseling and get her order. They wanted me to do, you know. I'd already completed an inpatient 30-day program for 7 months. I wasn't about to do that. But anyway, they thought that'd be a great idea. The state board did. Now, let's get back into that 30-day program. And I said, and I thought, shut up, Karen. Just do what they ask you to do. So they already knew I'd been in there. But I went to the treatment center, and they said, this is absurd. You've already completed all this, but give us the paperwork, and we'll just sign it. You know, you come and see us once a week, and we're okay with that. So anyway, I never really did do that, but they don't know that, let me tell you. But anyway, and I went to see a psychiatrist, and I'd known this guy for years, and he said, Karen, why won't you come and see me? He said, you are doing well. I know that you're sober, Nay, and you're doing well. You've been sober for a year and a half. My God, what are you doing coming to me? He said, listen to people in Alcoholics Anonymous. See, I love that kind of medicine, let me tell you. But he said, you know, give me the paperwork, I'll take care of it for you and stuff. So, you know, I did those two things, and I had to find a job under the direct supervision of another registered nurse for a year. And that's tough to do when you can't carry narcotic keys, let me tell you guys. And you know, that hospital's paying for two jobs for the price of one. And there's some things I can do, some things I can't do. And I was to let everybody know where I applied for jobs what was wrong with me. And that is a humiliating thing, let me tell you guys. But by God, I did it. I wanted my license back. By now, I was on a crusade, let me tell you guys. But I went to every hospital in Lincoln. There's three of them. And they all knew me. And they said, Karen, we would love to help you. And I think they really meant that, you guys. But they said, we can't afford to do this. We absolutely cannot afford to do it. And so I went out to the state hospital, which is a psychiatric hospital. And I'm not a psychiatric nurse. I really don't like working with those people because I can identify with them. But anyway, I went out there. And the guy that was the CEO of that hospital, he told me, he says, you know, he said, let's sit down and talk here. He says, you know, we got a nurse retiring, and this woman is bad news, but we don't want to fire her because she's been here for 40 years. It's just easier to let her stay here than to fire her and stuff. And they said, but if you can do her work, you got the job. And I thought, can I do her work? I can do yours too. But anyway, so I went to work at the Lincoln Regional Center, and I was there for 4 years. And you guys, you know what? I wound up by loving that job. I absolutely loved it. I worked with 20 mentally retarded guys. They were autistic. They were just wonderful. I loved taking care of these patients, and I never thought I would ever love doing something like that. So anyway, at the end of that 2 years, I did that for two solid years under direct supervision. And what this woman would do is I'd get to work and she'd go to bed is what she'd do. And so I took care of all the patients. I gave the drugs, everything, and I wasn't supposed to be doing that. And she says, oh, you're okay, you're sober, that's fine with me, you know. And I mean, that scared me to have to do that. And I talked to Clancy about it, and he said, you have no choice in this matter. You have got to be under the direct supervision of another nurse. You got to do what you got to do. And he said, whenever you get in that narcotic cupboard, that stuff is not yours, Karen. That belongs to God and the people that live there, the people that work there. That is not your medicine. Stay away from that kind of stuff. And so I was able to really work a third step and 11th step on that, you guys. And I never really wanted to take anybody ever. I wanted my license back is what I wanted. So it all went well for me. But at the end of that year, 2 years, I met with the State Board of Nursing in Nebraska. And this is what I want to tell you guys about. This is one of the happiest days of my whole life. I knew I had done well. I'd done everything they asked me to do. I dropped those urine screens. I'd done this, that, and the other thing, and I'd done it very, very well. And I had all my eggs in one basket, let me tell you guys. And you know, I wanted that license back, and I wasn't going to be okay if I didn't get it back, let me tell you. But and my sponsor knew that. And so about 2 weeks prior to that hearing, he told me, he said, you know, just you're going to be fine. He said, if you don't get the license back, we're going to try again. That's what we're going to do. Well, I don't want to hear that. I want to hear we're going to try again. I want my license back. So anyway, the day of my hearing, and Clancy knew I was terrified, you guys. And I got a phone call about 10 o'clock in the morning. Now, this is the value of picking up your telephone and answering it and stuff. You know, we didn't have caller ID in those days and answering machines and stuff like that. You just picked up your telephone when it rang. So, and I wasn't going to answer that phone. I was in bed, and I was paralyzed with fear. You have no idea. That hearing was at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I wasn't sure I was going to be able to get out of bed. I was so scared. And it was my sponsor. At 10 o'clock in the morning, he said, get out the airport and pick me up. You'll never get that license back without me. And I thought, oh, my God, he flew to Nebraska to be with me. And, oh, you guys, I mean, to this day, I just cry when I talk about this. And he said, get out here and pick me up and clean out your dirty car. I don't want to be in your car when it's dirty. You know. So anyway, I mean, you know, what a kind thing that he did. What a kind thing. And I said, oh, Clancy, I can't believe. He said, just shut up and get out here and get me and hurry up. And so anyway, we went to the state board together, and they all knew who Clancy was and stuff, and they were real glad that he was my sponsor, and they were very impressed that he was there, let me tell you guys. And so on the middle of the table, all these ladies were there, and they were having a little tea party for me. I just love tea parties, you know. But anyway, in the middle of the table, they had a great big purple box with a ribbon on it, and inside that box is my license, you know. I mean, what a precious gift of my life. And I have nobody to thank but Alcoholics Anonymous, let me tell you guys, because you're the ones that walked with me through every single second. And they said, welcome home, you're fully reinstated, you know. And Clancy says, let's get the hell out of here right now. And we had to hang out for an hour or so. But anyway, you know, thank you so much. Let me tell you guys, I owe this program my life on that one thing all by itself, let me tell you. So, you know, right then I want to talk about what happened for me when I made amends to that state board, when I did what they asked me to do, and I got that license back. I got promised 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 8, 9, 10, and 11. Every one of those promises came true in my life on that single day. I felt, you know, the one I really want to talk about is that my whole attitude and outlook upon life changed. It just changed right on the spot and stuff. So, and the state board told me, they said, Karen, you know what? Well, this is what we want you to do. We want you to spend the rest of your sobriety working with other nurses. That's what we want you to do. We want you to be an example here. And, you know, when I first went up there to get that license back, you guys, they told me, they said, you screw up, we're never doing this again. And, boy, the heat was on me, let me tell you. But, you know, I knew I was done drinking, you guys. I was done. I've been taught certain actions here will keep you sober. And I knew that worked for me. So I wasn't really that worried about it, you know, the truth. But, I mean, I really had to work I had to work harder that second time than the first time getting my license. But anyway, you know, I want to tell you guys what happened on my 20th birthday. Clancy, over the years, I mean, I still visit with the state board because I call them and see how they're doing. And actually, I 12-stepped two of them over the years, you know. Two of them are sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. But anyway, so I call them once in a while. And so we keep track of each other over the years and stuff. They don't want to know anything about me, but, you know. And so anyway, on my 20th AA birthday, Clancy got a letter from the State Board of Nursing, Nebraska. And they said, dear Clancy, we want to congratulate you on Karen's 20 years of sobriety. And we want you to know that she has blazed the trail for 2,500 people here in Nebraska. What a precious gift that was in my life. Oh, my God, what a precious gift. And I didn't know he got that letter. And at my 20th AA birthday, he read that letter to all the people in the Pacific group. And I thought, oh, I just sat there and bawled, you know. But anyway, so I'm more than happy. And, you know, when I moved to California, I got a phone call from the State Board of Nursing in California. And it scared the hell out of me is what it did. Because Nebraska told me, they said, do not tell California anything about this. Your records are sealed here. You never have to repeat any of this information. So they said, we're not encouraging you to lie. But lie, right? And so when I transferred my license, have you ever been treated for alcoholism or drug abuse? No, that's what I wrote down. They never questioned, and I got my license transferred out there. So when I got that call from the State Board of Nursing in California, you understand my dilemma here. And I called up Clancy, and he said, what do they want? And I said, I have no idea. And he said, well, call them up and see what they want, and be very careful with this, my dear. So anyway, I come, they said, Karen, you know, we'd like to send a couple nurses to you out here in California. That we need some help with these people, and we don't know what to do with them. And I thought, why? How did they even find out about me? You know, apparently somebody heard a tape or something. So I said, well, sure, of course I would and stuff. But you guys, you know what? That did not turn out well for me, and I'll tell you why. These people were alcoholics. They were members of Alcoholics Anonymous, these nurses, and I became their sponsor. And pretty soon the State Board of Nursing was wanting to question me about these girls' activity. I am not doing that. I am not divulging information about one of the people I sponsor to anybody. And I made that clear when I agreed to do this stuff. And they said, we have to know this stuff. And I said, then find somebody else to work with them, because I'm not doing it. Now, I still get a huge quota of nurses that call me and stuff. I still work with people, but I don't work with the State Board of Nursing on it, I can tell you right now. It's a bureaucratic thing. I want nothing to do with it. And you know, 2 years ago, I was invited to sit on the State Board of Nursing in California. It's a big honor, you guys. It really is and stuff. But you know what? It's a paid position. They want an alcoholic on that board, and that's probably the best thing that could ever happen to that board, but it's not going to be me. It's a paid position. I do not get paid for what I talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous. I refuse to even get into that kind of stuff. So anyway, I said, you know what? I'm greatly honored here. Thank you so much, but at this time, I'm going to have to turn it down. I'm just way too busy, which is really true, you guys. That's not even a lie. That's very true. So I slipped out of that one, let me tell you. But you think I want to sit down with 10 women that are not alcoholic on a weekly basis? You're out of your mind. You know, I'm not going to do it. But anyway, I just wanted to share that with you guys, because so many precious things have happened to me because of all that stuff, which are all related to the promises and stuff. Let's see here. Okay. You know, sometimes I get a lot of criticism for what I say in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I get criticized by a lot of women all over the world, if you wanted the truth. And you know what? I could care less what they think, if you want to know the truth. I am telling my story. It's my story. This is what happened to me. I'm not telling anybody else's story. And, you know, I had some lady tell me one time, she said, you know, well, you should be, you're an example of Alcoholics Anonymous. You should watch your mouth. And I said, you know what, why don't you watch yours, you know? I am telling my story, not yours, and I don't think I say anything that bad up here anyway, if you want the truth. But, you know, what I have found out here, you guys, it is so important for me to never regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. And also, it says, where'd it go? Oh, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others, you know? And I use those things all the time in my sobriety, and it's always turned out very well for me. The greatest thing that can ever happen to me is when I give an AA talk or just share in a meeting or whatever the case may be, and some woman comes up to me and tells me, Karen, thank you so much. I did that stuff too. Thank you so much for talking about that. Who cares what these other women think? I could care less, you know. And that's what this is all about. One alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. And so that's what I got to really key in on and not worry about the personalities and stuff too much. But let's see here. I just think that stuff's so important. Let's see here. Okay. On page 75 in the big book, which are great, great promises. And this is outside of the amend promises. It says, we pocket our pride and go to it, eliminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone with perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we're on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. Now, they're talking about after you read your inventory, in my opinion. That's what they're talking about. Now, I want to tell you guys what happened to me. These things have all happened in my life, but didn't happen at this particular time. You know, when I read my inventory, my sponsor, and I dumped stuff on that man that made me sick to my stomach. And I said, I don't feel good. I feel terrible, if you want to know the truth. And he said, why would you feel good? He said, look at the stuff you did. Why would you feel good? He said, where did you get that from? And I said, well, that's what people talk about. And he said, that is podium propaganda. He said, most people after an inventory do not feel good about what they did. What they're going to do is feel good when they make their amends. That's what this is all about. You know, and I hear people, you know, get this podium, and they talk about how wonderful, and maybe they did feel wonderful. I'm not saying they didn't, you guys. I'm not saying that. I'm just telling you my story. That did not happen for me, but it happened for me every single sentence I just read after I made my amends in Alcoholics Anonymous. So eventually these things come true for me, but not, it wasn't a timely thing like the book talks about. But, you know, I don't think that makes any difference. We're all different people here, you know. But anyway, I thought that was funny. I had to bring that up. You know, I also think it's important to point out that, you know, I think sometimes that, I know that I do this, and I know other people do it too, that I get up here and I say, you know, that my life is wonderful, things are good today, and that kind of thing. And people that are sitting there in pain think, yeah, they don't even want to hear that crap, you know what I mean? And my life is good today, and I do talk about the painful things in my life today, even still. But I will tell you that, you know, I think sometimes when people get up here and they tell people that after your fifth step you will feel wonderful, you know, I don't think that's a good idea to do that. It's just my opinion. I don't think it's a good idea because I know I didn't feel good and I felt inadequate after I read my inventory. And I know some people that don't feel good and they die behind inventory point. They never work another step. They think this isn't working for me. I'm not doing anymore. And they drink and they die. You know, so I know that for me, I need to keep my mouth shut because I am not God. I don't know what people are going to feel when they're done with their inventory. And I encourage the women I sponsor. I know that I tell them, you know, if you don't feel good after this, don't worry about it. You know, you're going to feel good when you start making your amends. And that always comes true for them. You know, but I just kind of try to reassure them in that area. Okay, page 56 and 57, which to me is the greatest promise of all. Okay. His alcoholic problem is taken away. That very night years ago, it disappeared. Save for a few brief moments of temptation, the thought of drink has never returned. And at such times, a great revulsion has risen up in him. Seemingly, he could not drink if he even would. God had restored his sanity. What is this but a miracle of healing? Yet its elements are simple. Circumstances made him willing to believe. He humbly offered himself to his Maker. Then he knew. Even so has God restored us all to our right minds. To this man, the revelation was sudden. Some of us grow into it more slowly. He has come to tell to all who have he has come to all who have honestly sought him. When we drew near to him, he disclosed himself to us. You guys, I'll tell you, I am so grateful that I have a sponsor that has made me come to believe in a power greater than myself. Because I'm going to tell you something. I believe what this book says. I get a daily reprieve contingent on a spiritual maintenance of the power greater than myself. But, you know, I want to tell you what happened to me last year. And this is so bizarre. You know, over the 23 years that I've been sober, once in a while these things have happened to me when I want to drink again, but yet I shake it off quickly. You know, I make a telephone call or whatever I have to do to get rid of it and stuff. But anyway, you know, I know I'm an alcoholic, and I know I have never lost the obsession to drink. You know, and my book tells me, it doesn't say I'm ever going to lose the obsession. It says that I may lose the desire to drink, and I lost the desire a long time ago, but I have never lost the obsession. It's on the back of my mind, let me tell you. And that's why I'm so busy in AA, because I keep it on the back burner at all times and stuff. But I know if I quit doing this stuff, that I would get drunk. I know, there's no doubt in my mind about that. And I was going down to San Diego last year to give a talk, and it was Friday, and usually on Friday the freeways are just a nightmare going to San Diego. But for some reason, that 405 was wide open and stuff, and I thought, my God, this is going to be a quick trip down to San Diego. And everything was fine in my life. The sun was shining. Sun was shining, and I had the music blaring. I didn't have a problem in the world, and I mean, I was just having a great time all by myself in that car, let me tell you. And all of a sudden, I saw this billboard, and it was advertising gin gimlets, and I was obsessed with that. You guys, I was connected with that like a stink on poo, let me tell you. And I mean, I could not get rid of that, you guys. I couldn't shake that feeling off. And I mean, you know how the book talks about that there's going to come a time in our sobriety when AA can't help you, God can't help you. And I mean, I felt I was slipping into that thing. And I mean, I could not shake this feeling off. And I don't think I was going to drink that minute, but by God, if I'd have entertained it much longer, I was going to, let me tell you. And I got off the freeway you know, first of all, I went to God. I said, God, get me off this freeway. And let me call Clancy quickly, and I'm so glad I did that and stuff, and got off the freeway, made that phone call, and I was laughing about it 20 minutes later. But it wasn't funny when it happened, let me tell you guys. And that scared the hell out of me. It really, really did. It's a frightening feeling when no human power can relieve your alcoholism, but God couldn't with a fever slot, you know. And that's what I did. But, I mean, I need somebody with skin on it to talk to, too, you know. But I did go to my God. And get me off this freeway, please. And they made that phone call and stuff. And Clancy told me, he says, this is a real thing. This isn't a game we're playing here. This is serious business, little girl. And he said, you know, thank God you have a God. Thank God you have a sponsor, you know, that you can talk to and stuff. But I was so glad he was in the office, and I was so glad I got off that freeway. But, you know, I continued down to San Diego, gave my talk, and I talked about that night. And people came and shared with me, and they said, you know, that's happened to us, and they tell me their little stories and stuff, you know. That is a scary deal, let me tell you. But so what he's talking about here, save for a few brief moments of temptation, the thought of drink has never returned. That's been my experience, too. That's a great promise, you guys. Okay. On page 102, am I boring you guys? I'm sorry, but I just think I'm so interesting. Okay, page 102. Your job is now to be at the place where you may be the maximum helpfulness to others. So never hesitate to go anywhere if you can be helpful. You should not hesitate to visit the most sordid spot on earth on such an errand. Keep on the firing line of life with these motives, and God will keep you unharmed. That's what the book says, you know. Well, now, I've been in some pretty sordid places since I've been sober, on 12-step calls and things like that, but I have never been harmed. I've had 2 cars stolen, but I've never been harmed, you know. I just wanted to point that out to you. Okay, page 130. We're such funny people, because I'm sure you guys have got your favorite promises in the book, too. Those of us who have spent much time in the world of spiritual make-believe have eventually seen the childishness of it. This dream world has been replaced by a great sense of purpose, accompanied by a growing consciousness of the power of God in our lives. We have come to believe in He would like to keep us in our heads in the clouds with Him, but that our feet ought to be firmly planted on earth. That is where our fellow travelers are, and that is where our work must be done. These are the realities for us. We have found nothing incompatible between a powerful spiritual experience and a life of sane and happy usefulness. I want to tell you guys what happened. As I talked about, so I'm in the Pacific group, and we had a girl in our group that got a year of sobriety, and Christy, you know, she was real active in the Pacific group, and she was you know, our little star. You know, she was really doing well and stuff. And sometimes when people do too well, you got to watch out for that. But anyway, she went to Hawaii against her sponsor's advice and went over there for a little vacation, and she got loaded on heroin is what happened. And Christy went up in the hospital over there and overdosed on heroin and drinking all the stuff she was doing. And she came back to Los Angeles eventually and never got sober again. You know, she was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, she'd come one day, get loaded the next, whatever, you know. And anyway, 2 weeks ago on Monday, they found Christy in downtown L.A., and she'd been stomped to death, you guys. Absolutely stomped to death on 5th and San Julian down by Clancy's Mission down there. And they put her on life support for a while, and she was brain dead, and eventually they took her off life support. You know, Christy will never know what I have found in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what a tragedy, you guys. What a tragedy that was and stuff. But, you know, I'm not saying that as a threat to anybody in here. I'm just telling you the truth. You know, that happened, and oh, what a horrible thing that was. We were in shock, let me tell you. Okay, page 164, which is, of course, a vision for you. Okay. Okay, so see to that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. You guys, when I was about, let's see, I was about probably 2 years sober. We had a convention in Lincoln, Nebraska. It was called the Fall Frolic. And this one man that was running this convention, he would not let go of this convention. I mean, he ran it for 10 years. And I got on the committee, and I said, don't you believe in spirit of rotation here? You know? Well, he didn't. He wanted to run the convention. And there was a bunch of us that thought, you know, this is a bunch of crap is what it is. And so anyway, long story short is that convention did not do well, and he fired me off the committee. I said, you can't fire me off the committee. I didn't do anything wrong, you idiot, you know. But anyway, we started another conference, and it was called the Spring Fling, and we took a year and a half to plan it. We got a lot of advice from California. We got a lot of advice from Omaha, Nebraska, because we didn't know what we were doing. None of us did. And we put that thing on, and I cannot begin to tell you what a great pleasure in my life that was. You know, we had 900 people there the first one. That's huge for Lincoln, Nebraska. That's a lot of people and stuff. And Sybil Corbin was our speaker, Cliff Roach was our speaker, and a number of the old-timers came out, and we had a tremendous lineup, and went up to Omaha, Nebraska, and borrowed money from the Cornhusker Roundup to get that thing started, and they saw our lineup of speakers. They were more than delighted to give us the money, and the first bill we paid back was the Cornhusker Roundup up there, and we paid our bills, we made our money, and made money, and enough to pay the speakers' expenses and hotels and all that kind of stuff. And what a fabulous thing that was for me, you guys. What a great thing that was to be of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. So great events will come to pass for us and countless others, let me tell you. I'm one of the founders of that. I'm one of the founders of the Spring Fling. But anyway, I went back and they always asked me to come back on their fifth one. I went back and spoke, and on their 10th one, their 15th, and I was just there in March for their 20th one. So it was a great experience and stuff. But anyway, I talked to you guys last night about my little bear story from UCLA, from the little girl and stuff. I was going to tell that this morning, but I think everybody was here last night. Weren't there? Was everybody here last night?
No.
Uh-oh. Now I got to tell the story again?
No.
I will if I have time. Okay. You know, promise number 7 on page 83. This is so important, you guys. To me, it's so important. Okay, promise number 7 is self-seeking will slip away. Now, I don't know about you guys, but that's never occurred for me, not on a continuing basis. I mean, it has, but it doesn't stay that way, let me tell you. I'm always looking out for number one here, you know, but I will tell you that I spend a great deal of my day talking to other people. I spend a great deal of my day thinking about the women I sponsor, about anybody but myself. You know, my book says that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of all our trouble, you know, and the more I get out of me, the better off I'm going to do. And I have a primary purpose here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and Chris has asked me to talk about this a little bit. Yeah, I love Chris and Barb. They're such great people. But anyway, you know, I have a purpose here. I have to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. That's my purpose in life. And when I get out of that primary purpose, I'm in trouble immediately, let me tell you. You know, I have a boyfriend, I have a job, I have a home, I have this, that, and the other thing, and I take care of business. But I will tell you, when I get carried away with that stuff, I'm in trouble, let me tell you. This is my main focus. You know, I go to meetings every day. I have many, many commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a sponsor. I have a sobriety date. I work with others, and I'm very, very busy. I don't know how I could be in busier than I am, if you want to know the truth. But I suppose I could do one more thing. But some days I think that I can't too. But you know what? You know what? It has served me well. All this stuff has served me well because you know why? I have stayed sober for 23 years. And people like me cannot stay sober, I can guarantee you, without under the guidance of Alcoholics Anonymous. But, you know, I'm so grateful for this book, and I'm so grateful for sponsorship, and I'm so grateful for you and all of you, and I really mean that sincerely. I mean, you guys are my lifeline, and that's why I love these traditions. I want nothing to change in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want everything to be just exactly the way it was written for us in 1935, if you want to know the truth. And this book, in my opinion, is divinely inspired, and I think it's so important to talk about Bill Wilson today because, you know, Bill Wilson basically wrote this book, and I've been in a lot of the archives, and I've seen readings of Bill Wilson's that he wrote that are not even in our literature, if you want the truth, but I know one thing, that basically he wrote the big book under the hand of God, I can tell you right now, because that man did not know enough to write this book. He was 3 years sober when this book was written, and things happened to him. I mean, things that happened hadn't even happened to him yet, he wrote down about. Now, how can that be, you know, such as the promises? Those hadn't happened to him yet, and that has got to be the hand of God, in my opinion. So that's one reason why I came to believe in God, that this book is divinely inspired, and my sponsor taught me that. You know, you have got to become familiar with the big book. You have got to read this book. You know, I love the 12 by 12 too, and I'm not saying anything bad about it because it's very important to me. But this is majorly what I read. I mean, I read a couple pages of this book every single day of my sobriety. And I will tell you, I've started from the beginning, the forewords, all the way to the end. The indexes, all of the whole ball of wax I read. And I try to digest what I read. And you know what I found out, you guys? You know what I really found out? That after many years of sobriety, you know, every day I would read this stuff. And I know I've read that stuff hundreds of times before. And every year that book gets smarter. Every year the book gets smarter, in my opinion, you know. But anyway, I think it's very important to be in this book. This is our text. This is our program. Okay. Clancy, I was talking about self-seeking and stuff. Clancy, Clancy has taught me that, you know, I have got to get out of self here. Out of self is the answer here. You know, the more I think about me, the more trouble I'm in. For me, contemplating my belly button is not a good idea, let me tell you guys. But, you know, he has taught me to do three things I want to share with you guys. And he said, at every AA meeting, this is what I want you to do. Always go to the new people. Always say hello to the new people, welcome them, give them your phone number, the women, not the men, but give the women your phone number, and say hi to the guys, refer them to the men, you know, show them where the literature is, where the bathroom is, where the coffee is. There's many things that can be done in a meeting at Alcoholics Anonymous. And I mean, I can walk in here, I can see a million things that need to be done if you want to know the truth. But anyway, people that are sitting by themselves, you go talk to them. Anybody in that room needs anything, then you go talk to them. That's what you need to do. And you always thank the speaker. Always thank the speaker, Karen, or the chairperson or whatever. You don't even have to like them. Just thank them. You know, there's people in AA that I wouldn't drink with if you want to know the truth. But you know what? There's many people that I will tell you. But you know, I got to stand in principles and stay out of the personalities around here. And I find that impossible myself to do it most times. But I'm a master at doing it 23 years, I can tell you. I do not get involved in group politics, but I refuse to get in that kind of stuff. But anyway, those three things have served me well. And when I did those three things consistently, I found myself absolutely immersed into Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I was now in this thing big time, let me tell you. So I would suggest if you're new here today and you feel like you're not a part of, then do that. Get involved here. Oh, my God, it's almost 10 o'clock. I'm sorry. I want to tell you quickly here. Okay, a long time ago, about 30 years ago, I found myself in Winnipeg, Canada. And I was driving a stolen car. I was drunk, and I'd been at my boyfriend's house, and I didn't know the damn car was stolen, or I wouldn't have taken the damn thing. But I was going about 80 miles an hour up in Winnipeg, Canada, and the Mounties pulled me over. I thought the Mounties were on horses. I know they drove cars and stuff, but anyway, this guy pulled me over, and he said, "Do you know how fast you were going?" And I said, "No." He said, "You were going like 80 miles an hour." He said, "Get out of the car. I smell alcohol." And I said, "I don't live in your country, and you can't tell me what to do." Don't ever say that to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, let me tell you. And that guy jerked me out of the car door, let me tell you. And on the way out, I took my little purse with me, and I had this little chain on my purse, and I hit him in the forehead. And I mean, and the blood flew, you guys. The blood just flew, and I thought, oh, Karen, you have done it now. You know, every time I'm in trouble, I'll do one thing more to make it worse every single time. But anyway, I mean, this was a big man, and he was on his knees, you guys. And I thought, oh, obviously, I got arrested for that. And I spent a month in the Winnipeg jail and stuff. So anyway, years later, I got sober, and Clancy told me, find that Mountie and make amends to him. And so I called up there, and they said, "Lady, we have no idea who you're talking about. We destroyed the records after 7 years, and those people are all retired now. We have no idea." I said, "Oh, no, you have to find my Mountie. I have to find him." And they said, "Lady, leave us alone. We're busy." And so what are you going to do? You know, I tried to do it. So I called Clancy, and he said, "Keep your eye open and be of service." I thought, what kind of stupid direction is that? I didn't say that, though. Keep your eye open and be of service. So I tried to do that. So I boarded an aircraft about 5 years ago to Calgary, Canada, out of Los Angeles, out of LAX, to speak and stuff. And I sat down with this old guy, and he had a cast on his leg. And I don't like to talk to people on airplanes because, I mean, I say good morning to him, and I'm pleasant, but I read my dirty books on the plane, so I just want people to leave me alone. But anyway, but I'm pleasant to people and stuff. And so I said good morning, and we had a mechanical failure at LAX, and we were down there for another couple hours. So anyway, they were serving coffee, so I noticed this old guy had a cast on his leg, and I said, "Would you like me to get you a cup of coffee?" And he said, "Well, that'd be very nice." He said, "Thank you." He said, "You look so familiar to me." And I thought, I wonder why, you know, but anyway. Anyway, I got his coffee and sat back down, and he said, "Why are you going to Canada?" And I said, "Well, actually, I'm speaking at an AA conference." And he said, "Oh, my brother's in AA." He said, "Actually, I'm in Al-Anon." I said, "Oh, really?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "Oh, that's nice. And now leave me alone. I want to read my book, you know." But anyway, and he says, "I can't believe how familiar." He said, "Did you ever get in trouble in Canada?" And I thought, why would he ask me that? And I was starting to really feel weird now, you guys. And I said, "Why do you ask?" And he said, "Well, you know, I'm just curious. Did you ever get in trouble there?" And I thought, oh, my God. And so I told this guy this story that I went to jail in Winnipeg. And I said, "What did you do for a living?" He said, "I was a Mountie." And he lifted up a lock of hair, and there was a scar from 30 years ago. I had found my Mountie, you guys. Can you believe it? Keep your eye open. Be of service, right? And Clancy knew what he was talking about, I guess. But anyway, I mean, I had tears rolling down, and I was just grabbed him, and I said, "Oh, God, I am so sorry I did that." And he said, "It's okay." He said, "The whole plane's staring at us. Will you stop it and stuff?" But anyway, you know, we tried to get on the cell phone on the aircraft, and I wanted to call Clancy, and I couldn't get through. So he called his brother, who's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he asked his brother to please call Clancy and tell Clancy what was going on the airplane. So anyway, and his brother was more than happy to do that. So anyway, Clancy sent a message for him to tell us and stuff, and he said, "You tell Karen, I told her 17 years ago to keep her eye open and be of service, and by God, it's turned out very, very well for her. And I will tell you guys, looked out the airplane window, and the clouds were never prettier, the sky was never prettier, and one more time, I felt the serenity, the inner peace, the peace of mind that we feel we make amends in Alcoholics Anonymous." So you never know what's going to happen around here, folks. You know, thank you so much for letting me do this, and we're going to take a coffee break and come back and question Stump the Speaker. It'll be time to play Stump the Speaker. So thank you very much.
And answers, and we will go till at least till 10:30. If the questions are still going, we'll go till quarter till, but we'll end at the latest at a quarter till. And during the question and answer period, if you do have a question, please raise your hand and make your question brief. It's not an opportunity for anybody to share. It's an opportunity to ask a question. And also, as a reminder, this is an open meeting. Everybody's welcome, but only alcoholics participate, which means if you're not a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't get to ask a question. And Karen's going to open up the questions, and you can ask questions regarding the promises or anything else regarding, you know, getting to those promises, steps, sponsorship, meetings, etc. So with that, Karen.
Any questions? Yes, sir.
Liability fund it is for attorneys, and vouch for his attendance at a meeting in my house, which I kind of didn't want to do, and I did it, and I've never seen the guy again. It's been about 4 years. But what's your policy on stuff like that? You mentioned that. I mean, obviously I can't vouch for his sobriety or anything like that, but what about that notion of sort of saying to a professional organization, yes, this person is attending or something like that?
You know, I'm glad you asked that. That's really a controversial thing in AA right now. You know, we do have traditions here that we do not affiliate ourselves with any court system, nothing, period. We're our own deal here. And, you know, some meetings sign court cards, some meetings don't sign court cards, you know. And my particular home group will sign a court card, but you will also stay for the whole meeting, and you will put the court card in the basket. You do not get it till the meeting's over with. That's part of the policy in that. And I've been in meetings that they're group conscious. They do not want to sign court cards, and that's fine if that's what they want to do. You know, I have no problem with that. You know, it's a group's conscious. But you know what? For me, I am not putting myself in any position with any professional organization about nothing. You know, I will say, yeah, well, you know, yeah, they were here, but I don't know. I don't know if somebody's sober or not. How the hell am I supposed to know? I know that I am. I don't know about anybody else, you know. And that seems to be all that's important here, you know. But it's a thing. So, no, I won't do that. Mm-mm. I get myself in too much trouble doing that. Then they want to call me and talk to me about stuff. See, you know. I'm not telling anybody else not to do it. I don't do it because of my experience. It's not served me well. Yes, sir.
Hi. In regards to the ninth step, amends, did you ever prioritize amends that you wanted to make that were before your drinking years, say childhood vandalism as opposed to, you know, in your drinking years where there was something a little more?
Yeah, I did. Actually, I didn't want to make any of them if you want to know the truth, you know. But you know what? Because of my financial situation when I got sober, it was not pretty, you know. I was in debt, credit card debt, blah, 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 right? I couldn't do anything about that at that particular time. Eventually, I did, like I talked about last night. But I tell you that, you know, I have a sponsor that doesn't want to hear my childhood story. He wants to hear what I did when I knew what was between right and wrong, what I really knew between what was right and wrong. That's what he wanted to hear about, the exact nature of my wrongs. And, yeah, I stole candy bars from stores when I was a little kid. But, you know, and I paid that back, too, by the way. I did go back and talk to those people, and they said, just give us a dollar and get out of here. You know, forget about it, you know. But, I mean, I did take care of that kind of stuff because I thought we should do that, you know, and I think that we should do it, you know. But my emphasis for me was put on stuff that I did when I was pretty much out there drinking and the havoc I was causing. So, yeah, I did prioritize stuff by as I could do it financially is what it was. I mean, I stole a lot of money from people. I owed a lot of people a lot of money. And not only credit card debt, but I owed people money. My family, blah, blah, blah. My family amends were easy, you guys. You know, I want to talk a little bit about that. I'm so glad you brought that up. You know, my immediate family, my mom, my dad's dead, but my mother and my was dead when I got sober, but my mother was still alive, but they were easy. My sisters, my brother, they said, you know what, we don't even want to talk about it with you. We're so glad you're sober. I mean, they wouldn't talk to me for years when I was drinking. But boy, did they put on a rally when I got sober. You know, I'll tell you. You know, it didn't take much for them to come back. But I had to work hard for them to come back. But, you know, they were leery of me for a long time. But, oh, my God, I get so much support from those people, I can't begin to tell you. Where I have a problem with is my kids. My kids, I did a lot of emotional damage to those kids. My ex-husband and I both did the damage. And we didn't beat our kids, and they never missed a meal. But I will tell you, we emotionally rammed it right down their throats. And my kids are both drinking and using drugs, so that's what I'm dealing with. You know, they can't deal with it. They can't right now, and I have to understand that. But I have made my amends to those children, and I am an outstanding grandmother, let me tell you. And my kids appreciate that. They really do. And they tell me they love me, and I think that they do. But I can still feel that wall between us, you know. And you know what? They have blown that horn to me so many times that I can't do it anymore. I have made my amends. I'm not discussing it anymore with them. You know, it's in your ballpark now. You know what I mean? Eventually, I have to let go of that kind of stuff. And, you know, my sponsor, am I making sense? My sponsor taught me that other doors will open for me. He said, those kids may never come back. That could happen. And he said, other doors will open for you. Well, I didn't want to hear that. I want my kids back, right? But other doors opened for me long before my kids ever came back, I will tell you. I was, like, those other doors being other people in the program, other women I worked with, and so on and so forth, you know? And I was comfortable with that. And I'm okay with that today, amazingly enough. I'm okay that those kids may never, ever really give me the relationship I want with them. You know what I mean? Until they get sober, they may not be able to. I don't know. You know? But I know one thing, that my grandkids are so precious to me, and I'm the best grandmother you've ever seen. You know? They like my checkbook is what they like, but you know. Yes?
Thank you for coming. Mm-hmm. Can you give a couple examples, if you have that in your experience, of either being servile or being scraped when it comes to making your amends?
You know, I have the kind of personality. I have never been servile and scraping my whole life. You know, just the way I am, you know. I mean, I am not a needy type deal, you know. I can't stand that kind of stuff. But, you know, when I was on the street, I still looked down upon people. You know what I'm talking about? I mean, I'm serious about that, you know. You know what's scary about being on the street? That I got comfortable with that? That was scared the hell out of me, you know. That you don't have to pretend anymore. You can be what, you don't have to be any way. You're just the piece of crap that you are. You know, standing there, you know? People don't care if you lie to them. They don't care. They're telling you lies. You're telling them lies. And it's a horrible way to live. It really is. But yet I became comfortable with it. Am I making sense? Because I didn't have to pretend anymore, you know? And it scared me to death, you know? But as far as being servile and scraping, I suppose I'd have to say that with my kids, that I approached that from that, not that angle, but I approached that a little bit. And I got sick of doing that because I don't like myself when I'm like that. I can't stand myself when I'm like that. You know, my book says, and it says right here, it's God's people. We stand on our own 2 feet. We do not bend before anybody, you know? And I have to do that with my kids, you know? So there had to come a day in my sobriety that I was not willing to listen to their nonsense anymore, okay? I made my amends. That's all I can do. I can't really give you another example. I maybe with the state board, I was terrified, but I don't remember being servile and scraping with them. You know, I stood up to the plate, if you will. Yeah, I did that, and I shouldn't have done it. I am so sorry. God, I am so sorry. You know, I violated something that was so precious there. You know, I don't know about anybody else here, but I worked my way through school, and I worked my ass off to get my license, and I threw it right down the toilet. You know, and I couldn't believe I did that. You know, that's the disease speaking. That's the disease of alcoholism, you know. Like Bill Wilson talks about in his story, and the powerful influence of alcohol and sedation, he wound up on the rocks. That is just, when I read that, I just cried. I thought, oh my God, that's what happened to him. Not that he stole narcotics, but I mean, he was using, you know, sedatives and so on and so forth to get through his withdrawals and stuff, you know. Yes, ma'am. You know, I don't recall. I recall being afraid to go to work again, afraid to be in society again, afraid to sit down with somebody and have a cup of coffee, if you will. I mean, that stuff scared the hell. Yes, I can identify with that 100%, you know. But quickly, I mean, because that's the way I used to be, I got back into it quickly. Am I making sense? It wasn't like I never had life before. That's not true at all, you know. I'd thrown it away. That's true, but I mean, I got it back pretty quickly. But sure, I went through that. It was a big adjustment period for me. But see, you know, I'm very fortunate here. If I'd have gotten sober in L.A., I'd be dead, because they don't take care of people with no money in Los Angeles. Where I was in Nebraska, because of my record with that hospital, I'd been there for 19 years. That's a long time to work at a place. Everybody knew me, and they were more than willing. I had no insurance. I had nothing, you know, and they're more than willing to figure out a way to take care of me, you know. And thank God, I mean, I was dying from this, literally dying from alcoholism when I got sober, and I needed medical care, period. And I was in intensive care ward for a whole month, so like people sat on me for a long period of time, you know. And I mean, as a matter of fact, not only sat on me, I had a court order: you leave that hospital, you're going to jail, you know. I had bad checks out and warrants for my arrest and so on. That are all taken care of now, you know. Am I making sense? But I mean, I had a terrible time. I you know, I identify with that, you know. But yet I quickly got back into it. After about a year, I was pretty good. Yes, sir.
Could you spend a few moments addressing, say, a point of early sobriety, managing the difference between your perception of the promises and creating expectations?
Oh, absolutely. You know, members of Alcoholics Anonymous came to my intensive care ward and 12-stepped me, is what happened. And they brought this book with them. And they would read this book to me every day. And, I mean, I couldn't even hold on to anything. I mean, it'd fly across the room. I was in a terrible, terrible withdrawal. And, I mean, these people would read to me, and they didn't expect anything from me. Just listen to us and just keep breathing. That was my direction from these people. And they read the big book to me, and when they read The Doctor's Opinion, if you will, and I love that chapter. Oh, my God, I love that chapter. And he talks about alcoholism at its worst, you know, and that was me. And I thought, oh, my God, that's exactly what is wrong with me. I mean, I identified with that. But, you know, I identified with the book, and I understood a little bit of the book, but it was a long time before I was able to pick up this book and read it. It would fly across the room, you know what I mean? And so people had to read to me. You know, when I got my sponsor, and when I got Clancy for a sponsor, Clancy, as you, I don't know if you know this or not, but he travels a lot and he speaks a lot. So I still did in Nebraska. And so whenever he was in the area of Nebraska, and like in Kansas or someplace, I would go there. Those are some of the happiest days of my life, spending time with my sponsor going through this book. He's been through the whole 164 pages with me of the book, and the prefaces and the doctor's opinion, all that kind of stuff too. But I mean, we have read this, and he would make me read a paragraph to him. Then he would read that and tell me what it meant to him. And it was just precious. Those times were precious for me. And believe me, nothing I said was even remotely associated with what he said. But he didn't make fun of me at all. He said, that's what that means to you now. We're going to start with now. Now is where we're at with you, okay? And he also told me, he says, just be Karen. Just be Karen with me, okay? Don't be anybody else. Let's just start with that, you know? And so I was able to do that with my sponsor. You know, that's the first human being I've ever really dumped everything in my life on. You know what I'm talking about? But, I mean, I had expectations, like you were talking about. I have expectations. Of course I do. And they have never served me well, I will tell you. You know, if I wrote out what I wanted my first year of sobriety as compared to what I have today, I have nothing, but I have everything. Am I making sense? It takes a long time to understand that now, Alcoholics Anonymous. But, I mean, I don't have any big fancy car. I could care less about crap like that, you know. My bills are paid. I do know that. I don't have any bills, actually, you know. And my life is pretty much an open book here. And, I mean, you know, those things are not important to me anymore, you know. I don't expect anything from anybody around here, you know. I expect my sponsor that he's going to be there when I call him. I do expect that, you know. I expect a relationship with my God, but I don't expect anything from anybody around here, you know. You know, Clancy's always taught me. He said, "There's only one thing wrong with AA. It's got alcoholics in it. That's it, you know." So I don't have to worry about what anybody else is doing. I have to worry about what I'm doing. But certainly I had expectations, and I wanted those kids back. I wanted that nursing license back. I wanted these damn bills paid, and I didn't want to pay them either. But how am I going to get them paid if I don't pay them, right? But I mean, a lot of things I wanted taken care of. I didn't want to have to feel bad anymore. And my sponsor has taught me a very valuable lesson here. If you don't want to feel bad anymore, then it's up to you to do something about it. Get your mess cleaned up. Then you're going to feel good. And by God, that's true. You know? Did I get off the beam here with you a little bit?
No.
I have a habit of doing that. Thank you. They were from hospitals, a nursing home that I worked at, and two hospitals. And when I got sober, part of part of the direction from my sponsor was, you go to those hospitals and tell them what you did and make amends for what you did. Now, I want to caution you on something. 7 years had gone by, okay? I did not do that until that time element had gone by, because those are felonies, honey. That's felonies. And I didn't want to go to jail for it. And my book tells me that I have, you know, I'm a member of society again. You know, I can't be in jail for 6 years. You know what I'm talking about? I have a job. I have responsibilities and things like that. And so, you know, there's some wrongs we can never right. But I did right those ones. Those I can tell you. And I went to those hospitals. And one of them caught me doing it. They caught me stealing some morphine. The other hospital, the one that I walked out of, but we used to steal Valium, jars of Valium. We used to come in jars, you know, walk out of there with it. And I had to make restitution for that to the pharmacy. I had to pay for that. And they didn't make me pay for it. I just paid for it. I want that crap out of my life, you know. And like I said, I stood up to the plate and acknowledged what I did, told them what I'd done, that I was sorry, but 7 years had gone by. Am I making sense? So I couldn't get in trouble for it anymore. My sponsor was emphatic about that. Don't put yourself in that position. Because they could pick up the phone and call the police and I'd be dead in the water. You know what I mean? But and today, I wish that I would never done that. That's very true. I wish I never would have done that. But I did do it. And I don't kick the door on that. You know, I use it as a valuable tool to help other nurses. And I've made peace with that. I still feel bad about it. I wish I wouldn't have done it, but I don't really dwell on it that much, to tell you the truth. Am I making sense? Because my book tells me my dark past is the greatest asset that I have. Okay? So I've used it in a positive avenue. Chris, I'm sorry, I'll get you next.
In regards to sponsorship, I know you sponsor a lot of people. Do you have any sort of expectations or guidelines or rules with the women that you sponsor in terms of their activity level at meetings and the actions and so forth that they take?
Absolutely. You know, when another person, individual, a woman asks me to sponsor them, I say, you know, you may not even want me for a sponsor. We need to sit down and talk about this, you know. And I mean, I get them right there at the table. This is what I expect from you. I expect you to read this book. I expect you to go to meetings and be of service here, have commitments, and work with others. And I expect you to pray. I want that done immediately. Start praying, whether you believe in God or not. And I want those things done. And if you're not willing to do that, you need to go elsewhere, because I'm not getting in any debates with you about it, you know. And I want them in meetings every single day in their first year. Absolutely. They may not even get a night off their second year, you know. I mean, all I know is what's worked for me, and those things have served me well. And I'll tell you, I go to a meeting every day of my sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not saying that other people need to do that. That's my comfort level, and we're all different here. But I don't think anybody's got a comfort level when they're brand new in sobriety. You know, they need to be with us a lot. You know, I know that I did, and I still do. You know, and so I sponsor a lot of women with children. And, you know, my book says this program begins at home. My book says that. It's the last place that any of it works for most of us, but I want those kids taken care of. That's high priority stuff to me. You know, I don't want these girls in meetings every night and ignoring their kids. I'll tell you right this minute. So I expect them to go to a meeting that day, perhaps an early morning meeting, a noon meeting, whatever they can work out, you know. But I think they certainly need to be home a couple nights a week taking care of their children. Am I making sense? And, I mean, I sponsor people as individuals. You know, it's not like a group setting with me. I mean, it's people are individuals. Everybody's got different problems, different stuff they got to take care of. And so, you know, I want them to call me every day and really make a connection with me every day. And if I'm not home, I will call them back, and they know that. Okay? Yes, ma'am. You know, I suppose everybody feels different about this. You know, I know that I mean what I say. I want you in meetings every day. My sponsor expected me to do that, and they need to do it too. And if people don't want to do this stuff, I'm not going to, you know, I sat down with them initially, and they said they would do that. They agreed to do that. And so now I got leverage here, okay? You're not doing what you promised me you'd do. What is the problem here, you know? And I don't want to hear any excuses. I want to hear what the problem is. Let's get it resolved. And I'll work with them for a while, trying to get it resolved so they can get back into their meetings and stuff. But you know what? I'm not doing that. I don't have time to do that. I'm not a babysitter here. You know? I'm a sponsor. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have my own deal here to take care of. You know, I'm not a babysitter for anybody. You know? I'm not running after people. Okay? But by God, I used to, I'll tell you. It would bore me to a frazzle doing it too, and it didn't do any good at all, you know. You know what we are, what we're like, you know. I know that I don't, you know, Clancy sponsors people the way he sponsors people, and I do too. And a lot of things that I do, I learned from my experience with him and what he's given me to do, you know. And I know what's worked for me, and I know what hasn't worked for me, you know. And so that's what I base it on, is what I've been taught and what's worked for me. Am I making sense? Because of what in your home? I'm sorry.
Opposition by my spouse. And and my sponsor's here, so, you know, I feel free to I hate to say the word complicated, but it feels complicated. I don't want to injure him or my children, but I don't really want to go bankrupt like he wants to. And I don't even know if I should be asking this. I'm fairly near here.
No, that's fine. I understand that.
Yeah, so I'm confused about that. I've listened to your tapes, and I heard you last night, and you paid back every dime. And it was a lot.
But I didn't want to pay it back.
I know. But like, well, you paid back every dime 20 years ago. You know, that's a lot of money. And
yeah. Your experience that you're married, right? Okay, I wasn't married when I got sober, okay? And so I'm free to do whatever I want to do, pretty much, okay? And when you're married, you have a marriage that you need to take care of. Of course you do, you know. You have to be accountable in that marriage. I don't like being accountable. And that's why I'm not married, you know, if you want to know the truth. I have a boyfriend, but he lives in New York and I live in Los Angeles. I mean, we see each other two or three times a month, go to the show, movie, have dinner, get laid, and don't call me tomorrow. You know, works for us. How did I? Oh, can't believe I said that. Please do not tell my sponsor that I said that. But it works for me. Why am I even bringing this up? Anyway, so what I'm saying, my situation was different from yours, but I understand what you're talking about. I mean, we can't take away from the home because of our past, I can tell you right now. But yet that stuff's got to get taken care of. You know what I mean? So you're in a real precarious situation. What does your sponsor suggest that you do? Yeah. You know, when you were talking about you couldn't make substantial payments to these people, you know. I mean, I know they want their money and they want it now, okay? They don't want your $5 a month the next 80 years. You know what I mean? Believe me, I went through that. But, you know, I'm very fortunate in my situation. I want to explain it to you. I this is what I had to do. You know, Clancy told me, you're not filing bankruptcy. Figure it out. Get four jobs. I don't care what you do. You're not filing bankruptcy. I don't believe in that kind of stuff. Sometimes people have to do that, but we're talking millions of dollars here. You know, we're not talking millions of dollars here with you. Well, to me, it was $1 million, let me tell you. But that's a lot of money for Nebraska, you know. But anyway, you know, I mentioned it to my mom. And I wasn't trying to get money from my mother. I just thought, I don't know what I'm going to do. And she says, you know what? She said, let's mortgage two houses. Let's mortgage two houses and get you a couple loans. I said, Mom, that was not my intention. Please believe that, okay? And my brother-in-law and my sister mortgaged their house, and my mom mortgaged hers. And we came up with two different loans. We came up with the money. And I mean, and I was heavy into it now, let me tell you. And believe me, every payment was made on time until my mom died. I almost had it done by the time she died, so she knew I was paying it back, you know. But I would never miss that payment, you know. And she told me, you miss one payment, don't you ever speak to me again. But I didn't ask for the money, and I didn't want to do it. And I talked to Clancy about it, and he said, how else are you going to do this? It's not, you can't do it. It's impossible almost, you know. And I mean, you just got to do the best you can do. And so anyway, that's what we did. I was very fortunate. And those loans are paid off, and they were paid off, you know, about 4 years ago. But I understand your situation. You know, you will come up with an answer if you do the footwork around here. You will come up with an answer for yourself. Maybe you have to get two jobs. I don't know. Do you work? Yeah. Anybody else? Yes, sir.
I heard you talk last night about spirituality and how you prayed for 4 years and then at this meeting in Canada. I'm curious how that evolved into your concept of a higher power. Could you talk about that a little bit?
You know, I'm not a religious person. I was raised in the Methodist Church, and I went to Sunday school when I was a little kid, and you know, but I didn't believe that stuff when I was a little kid, if you want to know the truth. You know, I used to have the pictures in our Sunday school. I'm not saying religion's part of this. I'm just telling you my deal. Pictures of Jesus with the little lambs, and I thought, that didn't happen. I mean, I just, when I was 4 years old, I used to think that kind of crap, you know? And I never did well in organized religion at all. But, you know, when I got sober, I felt a compelling urge to go back to church. I don't know what that was about. I have no idea. I've been to church for 30 years, you know, but now I'm going to go back to church. I felt I should be there for whatever reason. So I talked to Clancy about it, and he said, you know, you have to remember something here, that God just doesn't live in church, my dear. You know, but if that's what you want to do, hell, I'll drive you there if that's what you want to do. And so I went back, and he said, but you have to be careful. You have to be careful. And remember that, you know, if you can combine Alcoholics Anonymous and church, that's great. If you can't, you can't. You stay into AA. But don't quit going to AA because you're in church. I've seen people die that do that kind of stuff. But some people are able to do it and they stay sober too. But they're not alcoholics of my sort, I will tell you right this minute. But anyway, I went and talked to my minister, and he told me, he says, well, that's wonderful. He said, we'd love to have you come back. And he said, keep an open mind. Come Sunday and keep an open mind. And so I did that, and what I saw was hypocrisy, and I saw crap there is what I saw. And I wasn't okay with that. And I went and told him, and he says, Karen, you know what? You're going to find your God now, Alcoholics Anonymous. Bet you $5. You're going to find your very own God now, Alcoholics Anonymous. Very highly unusual that a member of the clergy would say that. You know, he said, just stay in AA. Just stay in AA right now. You're going to be fine. And you know what's amazing for me is that as much as I used to make fun of churches or whatever the hell have you, I can go in. We were talking about this last night. I can go into anything, whether it be a temple, a Methodist church, a Catholic church, whatever, and I feel comfortable because I take what I can use and I leave the rest. And I know that those places help people, and I understand that thoroughly today. That is their path. That's what helps them. Mine is Alcoholics Anonymous. So I found my very own God here. You know, today, did you see the movie Star Trek? I mean Star Wars? Remember the end of the song, end of the movie, The Force Be With You? That's what I believe, that God is a force for good. And I have to keep it just that simple. You know, I don't get into, my girls will say, well, what causes earthquakes? I said, how am I supposed to know what causes an earthquake? And what do you care for? Get to work. You know, they're on the phone wanting to know that this at 6:30 in the morning. You know, go to work. Shut up, you know. How am I supposed to know what causes earthquakes? Jesus. Am I making sense? So I keep it pretty simple in that area. But I believe in God, and I tell you, I really mean that. I believe that I've seen too many things happen in Alcoholics Anonymous. This book, people that really shouldn't be sober that are sober, that are doing well in the world, such as myself, many people that I know. Oh, yeah, yeah. Anybody else?
Time for one more.
Yes, sir.
What do you say when a person looks up they might qualify for chair and here, approaches you on the street and tries to bum luck? What do you say to that?
No.